Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Eke maue o mo whakalawalai atu I orana and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. While up on the show today, the US have once again withdrawn from another climate change framework. So what will this mean for the Pacific? US travel restrictions on Tonga are now preventing students to continue their studies.
Collective punishment seems personally to be a bit extreme, but what can I say? I'm not a US citizen, I'm a Tongan, so I was looking forward to continuing my educational journey, but unfortunately that now looms in limbo.
We also hear from a Samoan Muslim and his thoughts on the Prime Minister's goal to prevent other religions from practicing within the country.
It's not right. Everyone has their own rights to practice their own religion, however they want to pray and however they want to fast. It's up to the people.
And could the region have its first ever Pacific Youth Games? All that and more here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dupol. I say tagia tumas. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, the United States has announced its withdrawal from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's a global agreement that coordinates international action on climate change, and it has drawn strong criticism from environmental groups and could impact already vulnerable nations in the Pacific. Now, this comes after President Donald Trump took the US out of the Paris Agreement and also declined to send a delegation to the COP30 climate summit in Brazil. So to discuss this matter even more is Kaveh Gyllenpaa, Vice President for International Strategies, Centre for Climate and Energy Solutions. With that, I say good morning, Kaveh.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Absolutely. An important discussion to have, because if you could put it in simple terms, Kaveh, why has the United States decided to withdraw from the UNFCCC?
Well, as we know, this administration is quite sceptical about international cooperation on climate action. And under the previous administration, under President Trump, he withdrew from the Paris Agreement. And on his first day in office this year, he also announced his intention to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. So I think the fact that the US now also wants to withdraw from the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the foundational treaty on climate action dating back several decades, it's not surprising, but it's disappointing.
Yes, as you say, it's not a surprise with the US withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. So then, Kaveh, how different then is this move from that, though?
Well, I think it's a political statement that really speaks to his base. But in terms of what difference it makes on the ground, I think that's going to be marginal because, as you said, I think in the introduction, the United States didn't show up for the last COP, COP30, in Belém in Brazil, and had already announced that it was going to cease funding the UNFCCC. So in some ways, when we go to the COP31, which Australia is going to have a very key role in the organization and conduct of that COP, there won't be any difference because the US will also not be present there. So in some ways, we won't see any change. Of course, the thing that's disappointing here is that we now know that at least for the next 3 years, the US may not be participating. Mm-hmm. And it's very sad to attend these climate meetings and see an empty space where the US should be.
Yeah, and I heard you say that, do you think this decision is probably driven more by politics? And because of that, what argument does the US government use to really justify leaving the UN climate framework?
Well, it's just one of a number of UN organizations that the president announced that the US would cease to participate or to fund, I think it was over 60 in all in the recent executive order. So I think there's two things going on here. There's a general sort of withdrawal from multilateral institutions. But then, of course, there's also a specific skepticism around climate action in this administration. So I think there's two dynamics going on there. I think the thing that's encouraging is that the rest of the world is continuing to engage. Just a few weeks ago in Brazil, the other 196 countries of the world did come together and reached agreement on a number of issues. And there's no indication at all that anybody else is going to be following the US out of the door, because countries realize that they have to cooperate to not only respond to the increasingly severe and devastating impacts of climate change, not least in the Pacific, but also to seize the economic opportunities from the transition away from fossil fuels. Again, huge opportunities there, including for Australia in terms of the rare earth minerals that are going to be vital to fuel that energy transition.
Mm. And again, I mean, how significant is this withdrawal, you know, for climate action, you know, given the US is one of the biggest emitters in the world? Like, do you think this will weaken international efforts to cut emissions?
I think there's no sugarcoating it. It would definitely be better for the United States to be present. And I think it's really interesting that if you read the main outcome from the last COP, there was a line in there basically looking forward to as soon as possible for the UN, for the US to rejoin the international UN climate negotiations. And that part of the outcome was actually initiated by China and the European Union. So key economic partners and adversaries clearly want the US back because they need to be at the table. And as you say, the US is the largest historical emitter of greenhouse gases. So it's significant that they're not there. On the other hand, the world has been here before. It was here under the first Trump administration when the US withdrew from the Paris Agreement, and last year when the US didn't show up to any climate meetings and the rest of the world plowed on because they realize that climate change is real and they want to be part of the economic opportunities that the new technologies present.
Mm. And of course, we know that, you know, Trump has proudly said that, you know, climate change or anything to do with that is like a hoax. But for us here in the Pacific, you know, it affects us directly. So then what does this mean for the Pacific, who often have really heavily relied on the US?
Well, I had the pleasure and honour for a number of years of being on the delegation of the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and I was a lead negotiator for the Alliance of Small Island States on mitigation. So I'm acutely aware of how vulnerable the Pacific is. And of course, the Pacific and the islands are a very strong voice in the climate negotiations, a voice of moral authority that puts a lot of pressure on other countries to act. And it's absolutely critical that the Pacific continues to do that, particularly this year where Australia has worked so hard to make the COP31 being a COP that's also in partnership with the Pacific. So there'll be an important voice there. But there's also very important strategic alliances and considerations here. You know, the US has strong strategic interests in the Pacific. It has a number of military bases, some of which are in the Marshall Islands. Climate change is going to put all of that under threat. And of course, China is continuing to try to extend its influence with the Pacific region. So, yes, there are very strong vulnerabilities, not least at all nations such as the Marshall Islands, who are only a few feet above sea level. But there's also opportunities there, and I think that the US can be persuaded to strengthen its alliances and see the vulnerabilities and act on them in the region.
Kaveh, do you think then, you know, with the US withdrawing, this agreement, do you think then other countries could fill this leadership gap then?
Well, we saw the beginnings of that at COP30, where the European Union was put into a much more prominent role than normal. I mean, of course, it always takes a leading role, but with the US present in the climate negotiations, it was one of a number of developed countries. But we saw the European Union stepping up to a much more prominent leadership role there. But of course, in line with the shifting geopolitics and the shifting influences that we're seeing globally, other countries are also starting to step up into that leadership role, not least, of course, China, whose domestic action on climate change is pretty formidable when you look at the rate of transition towards renewables in that country. It's quite staggering, the sort of numbers that are coming out there. And of course, China still, like others, has to do more. But the indications are that we may have seen peak emissions and we might be on the downward trajectory. So, yes, other countries will need to step up. I mean, the gap can't be filled completely because, as you say, the US is the largest historical climate polluter. But others do need to fill that gap. And I think the Pacific in particular this year has a very strong role to play in terms of moral leadership, but also leading through example. A number of Pacific countries have shown how the energy transition is possible and are also leading the way on adapting to climate change, because it's a cliche, but no country is immune from the effects of this, not least the United States, who suffered devastating impacts over the last few years as a result of climate change.
Yeah, well, let's just look at that. I mean, looking ahead, though, what should Pacific leaders or communities be doing in response to this move?
Well, I think looking back to the lessons of the adoption of the Paris Agreement, the Pacific Islands had a very central role in that, particularly under the leadership of Tony de Broom and others, in persuading the developed countries to move forward and also to centralize the notion of limiting climate change to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. There was a famous meeting between Pacific leaders and President Obama in the lead up to the Paris Agreement that was very influential in shaping the outcome. Those kind of events happen once every decade, and we're now 10 years on from the Paris Agreement. And I think this could be the moment, particularly with the willingness of the Australian government, who are leading the negotiations of COP31, the willingness of the Australian government and for advocating for a strong role for the Pacific Islands. I think this could be the moment for the Pacific to really come together with a strong voice of moral authority to press the rest of the world to take accelerated action. Mm. And while that may not, in relation to the US, necessarily be through the blunt lens of climate change, because that's not what this administration in Washington is leaning into. There are other avenues such as economic cooperation and security that intersect very strongly with climate action that could be ways that the Pacific could engage on this issue with Washington.
Nice. Look, as we wrap up, though, Kaveh, I just want to get maybe clarification. Are you aware if this withdrawal, though, is permanent, or could they possibly rejoin again?
I think there's a lot of debate on this. I am a lawyer, but I'm not a US constitutional expert. I think it's quite interesting when you look at the exact wording of the executive order that the White House issued. They defined withdrawal as ceasing participation or funding. So I think we still need to see what that means. Is it that they're just not going to pay and not show up? Or are they going to do something which is more formal in the legal sense by notifying withdrawal to the United Nations headquarters? So I think we need to see what the case is there. But there's pretty strong legal perspective that if the president were to withdraw formally through executive authority, that a future administration would be able to rejoin through executive authority as well.
Look, Kaveh, great conversation this morning. Some really good insight to the situation. So I just really want to say thank you so much for joining us this morning on Pacific Beat.
Thank you.
That is Kaveh Gyllenpaa, Vice President for International Strategies and Centre for Climate and Energy Solutions here on Pacific Beat.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Each week, Politok dives straight into the tough questions, like who is actually stepping in to save people from sorcery, accusation, violence in Papua New Guinea.
So she was gasping for air inside the people in a group there, and then they accused her. Like, you must be the sorceress.
On Politok, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whakawe Lahi, thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. While the new US travel restrictions on Tongans, which officially commence in force from New Year's Day, the 1st of January 2026, under these new restrictions, visa issuance for short-term visits, tourism and business purposes have been suspended. It's a cause of frustration for many in Tonga and the America's Tongan diaspora, and has also triggered backlash from the American public. Whinau Whanua files this report.
The president is continuing to evaluate countries. Listen, if they don't have a stable government there, if they don't have a country that can sustain itself and tell us who those individuals are and help us vet them, why should we allow people from that country to come here to the United States?
That was U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem defending her government's new travel restrictions against a host of countries in an interview with Fox News. The list, which was first introduced in June last year, was recently expanded from just a handful of countries to 38, with Tonga among them.
I'm saddened that collective punishment has been the option that they have chosen to pursue.
For many Tongans like Leonor Funaki, the travel ban is disheartening. The Tongan American diaspora is estimated at around 78,000 people. Mr. Funaki formerly resided in the U.S., and like many Tongans from the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints, he moved there to study at Brigham Young University. However, the new restrictions prevent him from returning to the U.S.
I understand in the name of national security and interest of the United States, certain measures have to be made. But collective punishment seems personally to be a bit extreme. But what can I say? I'm not a U.S. citizen. I'm a Tongan. I'm grateful for the opportunity. I've been educated in the States. I was looking forward to continuing my educational journey, but unfortunately that now looms in limbo.
The White House has said a high rate of Tongans overstaying their visas is one of the reasons behind the restrictions, as well as frustration with Tonga's refusal to accept the repatriation of Tongan citizens convicted of crimes. President Trump's new travel restrictions have been touted as an effort to protect the U.S., but the decision to include small U.S.-friendly nations such as Antigua and Barbuda, Dominica and Tonga have attracted domestic opposition.
The basis for Tonga being placed on the list was the number of Tongan nationals who reside in the United States who have overstayed their visas. That's a problem that can be solved through diplomatic relations with the Kingdom of Tonga. We need not enact these draconian restrictions.
Among the vocal opponents is Hawaii State Senator Jared Keoho-Kalole. He says the new rules go overboard and says that travel restrictions come off the back of new immigration laws that empower immigration officers to racially profile suspects so that anyone who looks Tongan could be arrested.
They are allowed to take into account a person's skin color, mannerisms, speech in their investigations. And so the big problem I have with that coming from Hawaii is that if Tonga is now on the list of countries that are restricted from entering the United States, then basically what the law now allows is for ICE agents to stop, investigate, detain, and potentially arrest anyone that they think resembles a Tongan national.
Not too many people are traveling for fear that something might happen.
Fahina Pasi, the executive director of the National Tongan American Society, says that travel restrictions, along with legalized racial profiling and an immigration enforcement ramp-up, has caused anxiety among the community. She says her organization has been actively advising the community about their legal rights and protections from the now feared personnel of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
What we tell our people is that if you see some strange people coming to your door that looks kind of fishy, don't open your door. don't open your door. Slide this red card under, and the red card basically says, you know, contact our attorney.
I think the main priority is to establish stability and continuity of government.
Tonga's newly sworn-in Prime Minister Lord Whakawhanua is yet to comment on the travel restrictions. The U.S. has long been the largest source of remittances to Tonga, with remittances the country's biggest source of income. The U.S. has also served as the land of opportunity for Tongan migrants seeking education, wealth, and a high standard of living.
I think the U.S. government is in every right to justify whatever decisions they make in the name of national security. And I know for a certainty that generations will be affected.
And that was Lionel Funaki, a former Tongan resident in the US. Welcome back to Pacific Beat, where we head around the region to get the latest headlines. And today it is brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, who is back in the studio from, I must say, a well-deserved little break. How was it?
I know, back for 2026, Aggie.
That's
new year, new season.
Absolutely.
You know, feeling good, injuries are recovered and all that.
yeah, but you had a good time off?
I did have a great time, actually. Yeah, no, I got to see a bit of the country that I hadn't seen before, particularly in South Australia,
nice.
Which was really nice. And obviously, yeah, some quality time with the family as well. And yeah, I think it's just that time of year now that we're all in where it's really only teachers and students that are still happy because I think everyone else is either back at work or back at school.
That's it. Well, welcome back and thank you very much for joining us this morning. A couple of stories here. We've got a new survey of Pacific workers in Australia. They've actually found widespread fear of speaking up about unsafe work. What's that?
Yeah, that's right, Aggie. So this report has raised concerns about how the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, or the PALM scheme, has found many workers fear retaliation from employers if they speak up about their unsafe or unfair work conditions. Now, this survey was conducted by the Migrant Justice Institute. They spoke to 370 PALM workers who suggested the scheme's strict rules are leaving many workers trapped in poor conditions, afraid to complain and unable to change employers. And in the report's overall findings, it actually points to a system where power sits firmly with the employers, while workers risk losing everything if they speak out. And some of the other findings are very interesting also. So 64% of those surveyed revealed they would change jobs if it were possible. 30% wanted to leave because their current workplace was unsafe, while 60% reported that they have already tried to move to be treated better. But perhaps the most concerning finding, Aggie, is that most simply felt unable to raise the concerns that they were having. And the main reason for that was fear, as we stated. So nearly two-thirds worried that they would lose their job, and others feared being given worse work, you know, being treated vindictively and things like that, causing trouble for co-workers or being labelled as a troublemaker and not being invited back to Australia. So, yeah, look, really, really confronting stuff.
Really unfortunate, yes, because obviously the reasons that they come here is to get, you know, better pay, be able to help their families back in the island. So it is unfortunate to sort of hear that this is going on.
But, exactly. They do sort of come here on an unlevel playing field to begin with. And when you hear about, you know, power potentially being exploited like this, it is a shame.
Yeah, unfortunate. Okay, well, look, let's head to the US now. The country has officially rebranded its foreign aid stance. What's that mean?
Yeah, it actually ties quite nicely into the climate change story that we heard earlier on in the show. So this particular policy quietly took place last month during a high-level conference in Washington where the State Department unveiled their new foreign aid strategy. And the strategy, Aggie, is very simple in that it ties development dollars directly to the commercial and security goals of the US. So this marks a major shift away from how foreign aid in the US was previously framed, which was as a moral undertaking, you know, something that was ethical, I guess. This is not that. This is a reflection of the Trump administration's view that foreign assistance should advance America's national interest above all else.
Okay, because I'm wondering then, what does that look like?
So according to experts, future aid will only be channeled into projects that promote US businesses abroad, reinforce national security priorities, and sustain Washington's strategic strategic reach. So nowhere is that recalibration more evident than in the Pacific, with virtually all their funding going to, you know, military assets around Micronesia, as well as others that you know, deliver obvious sort of economic benefit and security returns. So expect to see continued funding into those military assets around Guam and the Northern Marianas and Palau. The Pacific Islands Forum Fisheries Agency will also get continued support as it allows US-flagged vessels to fish in exclusive economic zones of 16 Pacific Island nations. Okay. So that generates a whole heap of jobs as well as millions of dollars for the US economy. But on the flip side, don't expect a lot towards you know, things like climate change and stuff like that.
As we've heard recently in the story we did at the top of the show. Okay, well, speaking of the US, Kyle, I understand leaders in the Northern Marianas have warned that a deepening economic crisis could hurt America's strategic plan. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a little bit ironic given what I just mentioned. But in joint letters sent to U.S. President Trump, the commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, as well as CNMI delegate Kimberlyn King-Hines, they've actually urged swift federal action to stabilize the territory's economy. So essentially, Aggie, it's been in freefall for several years now, sparked partly by a decision back in 2022 to pivot away from Chinese tourism in favor of military development. But as a result, it's a lot of its core civilian systems have begun to fail and erode in the time since, just due to that, you know, that lack of economic activity.
Yeah.
So it's left it highly vulnerable to further shocks. And according to the leaders, if the US don't step in and provide sort of infrastructure aid and or more foreign aid, I guess, things like infrastructure, workforce stability, and essential services that support a lot of those US operations are just going to continue to erode and be placed at risk.
Interesting times. Okay, look, let's head to sport now. This is interesting. 9 new laws will be imposed across professional and international rugby league. What are they?
Yes, that's right. So the International Rugby League, or the IRL board, they've confirmed 9 new amendments to the game, which will come into effect globally for 2026. That includes the NRL, the Super League, as well as the international fixtures, such as the Pacific Championships and stuff like that.
That's right.
I won't go through all 9, but
okay.
Essentially the focus on the amendments is on improving the game's flow, the consistency, refereeing, as well as player welfare. So I'll go through a couple of them. The first of them includes sort of locking the ball into the scrum. So deliberately doing so will now be deemed an offence, which I think is good. That does happen quite often.
Yeah.
Packing the scrum, so loose forwards are now required to pack correctly behind the second row forwards. And the last big new rule change, Aggie, is around grounding the ball. So new laws will state that a player must ground the ball using the front part of the body above the waist and below the neck. This confirms essentially that tries can't be scored, you know, with things like the back or the legs or it's not just downward pressure that means you can score a try. You've got to have control of the ball, essentially,
a keen, you know, a league player, that makes sense to you, right?
Like, it does. To be honest, I was hoping there would be, I've been saying this for years, I feel like I sound like a broken record, but I've been hoping for years that they would change some laws around the knock-on rules. I just think over the years it has just become increasingly ambiguous to the point where I actually just think we just need to start over and just basically put in the rule and just say, unless the ball hits the ground, it's not a knock on. Because the amount of times I find we're going to video referees, oh, it's a forward knock on first. Oh, no, that one was knocked back. I don't know. I just think it's gotten to the point where it's way too confusing. And it's especially hard to try and explain it to people who aren't familiar with the game, because it doesn't even make sense to a lot of the people that are. So, yeah.
Well, let's hope the league gods are listening to you this morning and might make another change.
That's my first rant of 2026. One of many, I hope, Aggie.
Oh, I love it. Okay, thanks again, Kyle. That is our producer bringing you the latest headlines from around the region here on Pacific Beat. Well, yes, you would have just heard those headlines. And if you've just joined Pacific Beat, I'm your host, Aggie Tobol. It is great to have your company this morning. Just giving you a quick recap of the show so far. Now, the US have once again withdrawn from another climate change framework. Also, frustrations build amongst the Tongan community on the latest US travel restrictions. Still to come, though, Samoan Muslims say the Prime Minister's decision to nab non-Christian religions to prevent some type of religious extremism is an overstep by the government. Meanwhile, solutions to cope with Samoa's ongoing issue with power still seems far off. And could the region have its first ever Pacific Youth Games? All those stories coming up here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fomoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Fatalo Fats and welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Samoa, where its newly elected imam said he is feeling scared after it was proclaimed that until the 16th of January, there would be a national period of prayer and fasting. Now, the policy will also require all public servants to take part in prayers and fasting every Wednesday for the foreseeable future. It comes after the country's devoutly Christian Prime Minister, Lauli Alemaliatole Atewa Schmidt, floated the idea of nabbing non-Christian religions to prevent religious extremism. Hussam al-Din Stanley, imam with the Samoa Muslim Centre, told Lucy Cooper the decision is an overstep of the government.
My view on this matter, it's not right. Everyone has their own rights to practice their own religion. It's people's right. They can fast, they can pray however they want to pray and however they want to fast. It's up to the people.
The proclamation also mandates weekly prayers and fasting every Wednesday across government ministries, corporations and statutory bodies. Do you believe this is an overstep?
Yes. For me, I believe it is an overstep. Some people they can't even have time on Wednesday. Some they have their own family issues. Some they have I've seen many people here who are struggling with financial stuff, so I don't know. It's up on the people, but for me, this is overstep. Everyone has their own religion to practice. Even in our own scripture, Holy Quran, it's not compulsory like to force someone into religion. Because even us, we know everyone has right to practice their own religion.
Can you tell us about the history and the role of the Samoa Muslim Centre in the community?
Islam started here in Samoa before I was born, 1990. It was our first masjid, our first prayer house was in town, up here. It was beside McDonald's, the location of McDonald's. And after some issues back then we moved here at Bayusu village, close to town. And then ever since then, we are still here at the Yusuf.
How has the Muslim community in Samoa evolved over the years?
Yeah, our numbers is growing, but not too fast, but slowly. Many of us are foreigners from overseas who come to work. They are really happy when they come here. When they came, they found a prayer house. So they come and pray with us here.
What steps are being taken to ensure transparency and understanding between the Muslim community in Samoa and wider Samoan society?
We are not that well known because our brothers and sisters here, Muslims here, we come here and then we live our life peacefully because we know that there's some issues involved with some chiefs and some churches and even the government. So basically we're just living our own life in a peaceful way, and that's why many people don't know, Islam has been in this country for more than 30 years.
How would you say the centre engages with the local community and other faith groups in Samoa?
It would be nice to have some open discussion. I mean, come with an open mind. There's a... Since the social media has been depicting us in the wrong picture, yeah, we are open to discuss. Yeah, everyone has, I mean, all over Samoa has some questions concerning Islam. They can come. They can come here. We can discuss with them, answer their questions. We are not forcing anyone. If anyone wants to join Islam, they can. If anyone wants to ask questions only, want to understand, of course we will give them answers. And then they can practice their own religion. We Muslims here are open-minded people. So, of course, we know the issues. We know certain type of questions they will bring. Yeah, we are ready. We are prepared for it.
How has the announcement from Samoa's head of state left you feeling?
A little bit scared. I'm just being truthful, because I don't know what will happen, because we are the minority here. So we don't have that much power, some voice to speak up. It's the government, well, they strongly support Christian all the way. So, yeah, that's how we feel.
What do you hope will change?
The thinking of people, their own way of seeing how what is Islam to them. And I hope my people will come and ask Islam. They have that sort of curiosity, if they are interesting. When Islam became more popular, hopefully the people will come and see like what's the living lifestyle of the Muslims and how we do our prayers, fasting, and all sorts of principles in Islam.
And that's Hussam al-Din Stanley, the newly elected imam in Samoa, speaking with Lucy Cooper. Meanwhile, in Samoa, ongoing power issues meant the festive season was not as festive as it could have been. Problems with the electricity network meant the country is still relying on leased generators to maintain supply. Now, the Prime Minister recently said a permanent solution is still some way off, but some locals don't think that's good enough. Samoa reporter Adele Fruin has the story.
Taliaina Tavita runs a small store in the northwest coast of Wallu Island to support his family. But the inconsistent power supply makes it hard to operate his business.
I operate a humble small store in our village. We don't have much, but we do depend on the power to keep our frozen meat in. The constant electricity disruptions have been a hassle for us, especially when the drinks we sell are not cold. People don't want to buy it.
After a previous government leased generators, Mr. Tawita says there was a period when the power supply was consistent. But he says it wasn't long before the blackouts returned and they continued all throughout last year.
Let's not forget, the power goes off for hours. The frozen foods are at risk of going bad. I support the government, but my humble advice is to please fix our power as soon as possible.
Last year, the situation was so bad, the government declared a state of emergency. The crisis is due to faults in the country's main underground power cable, damage to power lines caused by severe weather, and the failure of backup generators. Months later, Samoa's electricity supply has not returned to normal and is still being powered by leased generators. Recently, the new Prime Minister, Aulid Maliutoblantevafosi, said it's going to be some time before the situation is completely fixed.
The full generation capacity of electricity is expected to be restored by 2027 or 2028 following major upgrades of generators at the Fiaga power station.
But Samoans say that's too far away.
My understanding on this, they should fix our power because a lot of families and their frozen goods have been impacted. And also, they should issue a notice to inform people of any power outages before cutting the power.
Cut them some slack. The poor EPC workers were up all night and all day trying to fix our power. It's not their fault we have a lot of power outages, but I truly believe there is an electricity problem and it should be fixed now.
I agree with any change that will benefit us led by our government. I believe that fixing our power is a good thing, but that was 2025 and we are in 2026. I believe we should put God first, then prioritise education and the cost of living.
In the meantime, the Prime Minister said the government will investigate who was responsible for the failure to maintain the country's power infrastructure.
Somebody has to be responsible.
Somebody has to be responsible because we are spending a lot of money leasing these generators temporarily.
And that there is Samoa's Prime Minister, ending that report from Adele Fruin.
Pacific Beat.
Right, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to the world of sports now, specifically the world of multi-sports. An event is one of constant change, and for a few days recently, Indonesia was driving the idea of expanding the Southeast Asian, or SEA Games, to include Australia, New Zealand and Fiji. The suggestion was that eventually other Pacific Island nations might also be invited to take part. But the concept didn't sit well with other SEA Game countries, and instead they've decided to introduce the SEA Plus Youth Games. So the door opened briefly and then closed quickly for Pacific teams that would benefit from more competition more often. But what about a Pacific Youth Games? Is the region's own event a realistic possibility or a bridge too far? Here's Richard Hewitt.
Wind the clock back 15 years or so, and that's when the idea of a dedicated youth games was first raised within the Pacific Games Council. One suggestion was to reinvent the mini games as a youth event, but the council's chief executive, Andrew Minogue, says that idea has never been popular.
The mini games has always been established for the smaller countries, and a lot of them felt that they wanted the chance to have the region's best athletes appearing at a games in their country. So fast forward to last year in Palau, we took quite a big step forward in mandating a certain percentage of youth athletes to be part of each country's delegation. So we had 12 sports in Palau, and 9 of them had a youth component to the competition to some degree. So we are heading in that direction, I think, not moving to a youth games as such, but making sure that more and more young athletes, up-and-coming athletes, get a chance to perform at the mini games.
As head of high performance, Aaron Allsop masterminded the record-breaking performances by the PNG and Solomon Islands teams at their home Pacific Games in 2015 and 2023. He says creating more competitive opportunities for young athletes in Oceania is a must, but while a dedicated youth games would be the ideal, remodelling the mini games is likely the best option.
I think the model of what the Pacific Games Council are doing, where there's some discussions with Oceania federations to have an age restriction, whether it be completely an under 18 or an under 19 tournament, or it be that a certain percentage of the athletes for that sport have to be under that age group. So I think the model which was put in place in Palau is probably the right way to pitch it, and it's the right way to be able to still engage all of the members of the Pacific nations, but also be able to bring that youth focus into the competition.
What we're looking at for the next mini games, just to keep driving that youth component to make sure that more and more sports give more and more opportunities for the younger athletes, but at the same time, keeping entries open to the best athletes of the region, because they also need that competition to prepare themselves for other championships that are taking place in their calendars.
Now that Australia is a regular competitor at both the Pacific Games and the Mini Games, could there be a role for Pacific Oz Sports to play in expanding the amount of youth competition on offer? A spokesperson for the Department of Foreign Affairs told me that the Australian government is committed to supporting and creating opportunities for Pacific athletes, coaches and officials to access high-performance training and elite competition. And Andrew Minogue says already the signs are encouraging.
I think we already saw a little bit of that in Palau last year, with DFAT running some programs, particularly around broadcast support, to enable Palau to have a host broadcast capacity. We also had excellent support from the Australian government's team-up program for the safeguarding of athletes. Because we have a lot of younger athletes entering those games, we had a responsibility to look after them, essentially. But yes, we can certainly broaden that out to Pacific Oz Sports or other stakeholders to support the promotion of young athletes and youth competitions.
I'm not sure if the funding would be there to directly cover every cost of the athlete, but there is some merit to look at, well, how is it that we could support concepts where Pacific nations are putting in certain amount and Pacific Oz Sports could brand the event to provide this pathway for our youth athletes. So I definitely think it'd be worth a discussion and looking at ways that concepts could come to light.
And while a Pacific Youth Games is not on the agenda, the Australian government certainly has its eye on the Brisbane Olympics and intends to work with Pacific athletes on enhancing balancing pathways between now and 2032. And they made a good start ahead of the Paris Games in 2024, supporting a record number of Pacific athletes to attend qualification events, and nearly 120 from 15 countries went on to compete in France. But when it comes to athletes at youth level, Aaron Allsop says there is still work to be done.
I definitely think it's a significant gap in our pathways across the region. When you look at how much older some of these athletes are that are being identified and recruited into national teams that haven't come through a junior pathway program. So it certainly is a challenge where, you know, we've now got athletes that are coming through, but they're not actually ready through international competition exposure. So I think that part of the junior pathway is really missing for us.
Andrew Minogue says the Pacific Games Council is certainly keen to play its part in enhancing youth development. But when it comes to the mini games, something of a political and sporting juggling act is what's required.
The reason for bringing them in has been consistent all the way along. It is to enable the smaller countries to have a chance. So we've been to places like Wallis and Futuna, the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, Palau. And we had 2,000 athletes and officials in Palau, which is the most we've ever had by a lot at a mini games. And we're going to be looking at measures to make sure that for the Cook Islands in 2029, we try and keep those numbers sustainable, because we don't want the mini games to become too big that those smaller countries can't hope to host it.
What the Pacific Games Council leadership has done, where they've actually shifted to some of the youth age group for their competitions at a mini games, I think really sets up that event to fit this market. But when the Oceania Federations might be looking at something and how they could support a Pacific mini games focus where it is more of a youth orientated event, to potentially expand that program out a little bit more to help the host nations with some of those costs, I think that's probably the more sustainable direction at the moment outside of the regular Oceania Championships that individual sports may host. So ideally, it'd be nice to have a youth age event, but I think from a sustainability perspective, the Pacific Games Council have really started to see that need and shifted their sport program in that way, which turned out really successfully in Palau last year.
That's Aaron Allsop, roving coaching advisor and longtime sports ambassador in the Pacific, advocating for promising young athletes in the Pacific. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt.
So all our ABC Radio Australia listeners, welcome to 2026.
New year, new schedule, and the sounds of the Pacific right where you want them.
Yes, your favourite shows are now playing at times that suit your day, whether you're waking up, winding down, or anywhere in between.
The same trusted voices, great music, sport, news, and stories from across the Pacific, now easier to catch than ever.
Tune in, stay connected, and make ABC Radio Australia part of your 2026.
ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
DJ Noise. Am I doing that right?
Can I hear your best? Another one. Give us a DJ Khaled.
All right.
DJ Khaled!
We're the best music!
Another one.
Anyway, Nisha Daily, yes. Weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of a Pacific Beat. Now, recapping our top story, with new US travel restrictions on Tongans have officially commenced, much to the frustration of Tongans and the American public.
I understand in the name of national security and interest of the United States, certain measures have to be made, but collective punishment seems personally to be a bit extreme. But what can I say? I'm not a U.S. citizen. I'm a Tongan. I'm grateful for the opportunity to have been educated in the States. I was looking forward to continuing my educational journey, but unfortunately that now looms in limbo.
And that's Lionel Funaki, a former student at Brigham Young University. And if you want to find those top stories, just simply type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Our team will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. As always, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily with the boys, Michael and Jacob. So until next time, o tua o whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.